All right, I think I will start as usual by seeing what things you want to talk about from the reading from today, and when we run out of that, I'll see if I can think of anything to talk about. So, on the subject of eCash, which was the first part of it, I think, do people understand sort of the mechanics and the function and what it does, and what questions do you have about it? Anybody? Could people follow my sort of non-technical version of eCash, which is designed because the technical versions are complicated to demonstrate that it is indeed logically possible to do the impossible, so to speak. So are things or questions on eCash from what people? Yes.
Like some sort of
except that the bank knows.
Yeah, actually, there are some cases where a bank doesn't know who the clients are. Just have the other number, some kind of security word.
So they don't know who the person is, and can I write checks on that account?
Actually, the thing is, checks doesn't work in Europe.
So how, if suppose I have a Swiss numbered account, and when I originally established it, I didn't have to write any ID? No. So I go into the Swiss bank, and I say, here is a pile of dollars, set up this account, and my name for your purposes is such and such. That's my ID, my number, whatever it is, or you give it to me. And now I want to make a payment. What do I do? So, to another account. So we're imagining two people, each of whom has one of these numbered accounts, and now they can make transfers to each other without knowing who they are. Is that it? That's interesting, because that does sound like a version, a maybe somewhat clumsy version, but a version of something like an anonymous eCash.
There was a problem in Europe of, like, there was a lot of tax crimes, like the older holding accounts in Switzerland, and the Swiss banks were like anonymous accounts as well.
Yeah.
They were giving away information about the account.
Yes. So this is set up so that they cannot give away the information. And that's how they're now set up. Because there were cases where I think the U.S. government and others were compelling Swiss banks to give up such information. Very interesting. Yeah, because that's all what I think of as sort of the basic principle of privacy, which is you never let the information out at all and then people can't give it away. Very interesting. All right, other people have things? It all makes sense to everybody? You can see why there's a double spending problem and how you have to deal with a double spending problem. Why do we use credit cards now? That a credit card is really the most extraordinarily insecure equivalent of this that one can imagine, because, you know, every waiter in the country, if he feels like it, can collect a dozen a day easily. All he needs is to use his cell phone to photograph the pieces of paper he's handling, and yet we continue to use them. Why? What are the... Yeah?
Well, one of them is to build credit.
But the question is, why aren't we all being stolen blind all the time?
Oh, okay.
Given that it's easier for people to get credit card numbers, why is the system still usable? Yeah? So what you're really saying is that either I use it in real space, and then first I need the physical card, or I use it for something like online or telephone, and then products get delivered to me. So that what you wouldn't want would be a system which let me use it online to get something anonymously. So therefore, that's interesting. Suppose that I have your credit card number, and what I want to do is to buy software. So I operate through a remailer, through a anonymizer. Is there anything to stop me from using your credit card to buy stuff and being untraceable?
Well, the thing is, I mean, the account holder would have to be proactive about it and then have to block
out. Once you discover it, you can stop it.
Before discovery, that is a risky.
That's a risky. Yes. Or that the credit card company assumes, depending on the terms of the contract. Yeah. But, right, it's interesting. Because it's easy. After. I think it's often useful after imagining some hypothetical arrangement and proving it can't work, seeing if the same proof works for arrangements that actually currently exist. Sort of my standard example is the political one, that obviously the modern systems can't possibly work because the police and the army between them are a small part of the population, not terribly well paid, and they have all the guns. So it seems obvious that all of our systems must have long ago crashed due to police or military coups, and yet it doesn't happen. So that's sort of interesting if you're imagining any form of social organization, try to figure out what it is that keeps ours from crashing and see if you could figure out how that would apply to other ones. But similarly here, I think it's always a useful exercise to try to figure it out. So that looks like the vulnerability, and that looks as though it means that credit cards will become less useful as people do more and more of their transactions in forms that can be anonymized. That is, more and more of their interactions, not only in online, but not taking delivery of physical products. Presumably, nobody's ever cared enough about such privacy to set up physical remailers. You could imagine a firm, you could imagine a system, where suppose that people are often buying stuff that they don't want anybody else to know they bought. Say, for banned books or something in some society, some theocratic society, something like that. So you have a firm and a remailer, and I order the book from you. You send the book to him. How do we keep him from knowing? Somehow, he never find out. You send the book to him. He has a label from me that he sticks on it. He has a way of knowing that that label is for the book you're sending, and he promises not to peek before he mails it. It'd be nice to think of a more secure system. But at least if he obeys his promise until the police show up, then he can't give them any past information, although he could thereafter peek on it. I'm just trying to think of how you could have things physically forwarded such that it wasn't traceable. And I can't think of a good equivalent to the way you can do it with anonymous remailers, because that depends on public key encryption. But maybe some of you can think it up. My guess is there's not enough of a market in the real world for anybody to do it. But it would be a system where the sender doesn't know who the recipient is, basically.
If you have a physical email, there's so much risk for that, because you would want a remailer for
doing things that are disapproved of, and then the state comes down on them. Yep. Yep. That would be a further problem. Though you could imagine, suppose the remailer is in a different country and it does not put its return address. It invents a new return address every time it sends something so that the customs or whoever can't know that it's coming from them. So you could think about something like that, but because the original anonymous remailer, was the initial famous one, AnonPenetFi, did have the information. They basically just promised not to give it up, and they were eventually compelled to in one case. So it's better than nothing, but it's at least worth trying to figure out if there are mechanisms such as the one he's describing, which are secure in a stronger sense. Now, of course, even your mechanism does have a potential downside in that suppose that the non-Swiss country that wants to get this information suborns an employee of the bank, and the employee of the bank photographs people when they come in to set up their accounts, and then passes the photographs on to the CIA or, you know, KGB or whatever organization. What? And that would presumably be is that in violation of Swiss law? Should be. That'd be a sensible way of setting it up. If what you're really trying to do is to make it possible to offer people anonymity. Now, it's true that a lot of people who want anonymity are people who I don't approve of, because I suspect that a lot of those accounts are actually kleptocrats. They're actually rulers of poor countries who pocket the foreign aid and put it in their Swiss bank account. But nonetheless, there's something to be said for having institutions that let people do things secretly. Go back to the general question of money. Have people thought about the question, if you were first, of having private money, and second, of how one would set up a system of private money? That we're used to thinking of money as sort of a standard function of the government, But historically, it isn't true. That isn't something which governments have done, but other people have done too. That, as you may know, the U.S. had private monies in the 19th century, so-called wildcat banking, in which now the banks were regulated by the states they were in, but the banks were issuing their own money. And similarly, in 18th century England, and if you actually read Adam Smith, the banking system he's describing is one where the main money in Scotland is private bank money denominated in silver, issued by private banks. So what are the problems that that raises if you want to do that kind of a system? Anybody thought about them at all? Yeah. There might be, but what we're describing is not the state doing it, but a private firm within the state.
But when you if there starts to be any sort of state involvement, even at the slightest regulation,
But states regulate churches in various ways, after all, and nonetheless, the states aren't supposed to be involved with churches. Yeah?
So, like, one thing which you've granted to the Federal Reserve is that our U.S. dollar based on the full faith and credit of the United States economy, right?
What does that mean?
Well, there's no one-to-one ratio with, you know.
But I don't understand what the statement means. I understand when the U.S. dollar was on gold.
Yeah.
It makes some sense to say the U.S. guarantees that you bring in a dollar will give you gold or silver. But at this point, the U.S. dollar doesn't have, nowhere on that piece of paper does it say that it's exchangeable for some amount of some commodity. So what does it mean to say that the dollars are backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S.?
So, the way I understand it, the Fed is trying to say that, trust us
to do what? There's nothing. Would they be violating any contract or any law if they inflated the currency?
No.
And they've done it. We've had inflation in the past. Not big inflation by historical standards, but certainly, 10-15% occasionally.
But isn't trust that the Fed is monitoring the economy and it knows how much money to do it sensibly?
I don't think so. I don't think it means anything. That is, I would have said that if they sell a T-bill and say on the faith and credit, what they are saying is this T-bill says $1,000, bring it in, we'll give you 1,000 pieces of green paper that are dollars. And that's a meaningful statement, and whether, how much it's worth will depend on what you think happens to the value of the dollar, but it means something. But I don't understand what it means to say that a fiat money is backed by the full faith and credit of the government, because how can you have a contract that has no obligation? Right? So, in addition to which, of course, if it were true that they were guaranteeing to do a good job of running monetary policy, which they neither guarantee to do nor, I think, could do very well, because it's sufficiently unclear what you ought to do, that wouldn't be a reason to hold dollars. Because, after all, the reason you want to do a good job of running monetary policy is so the economy will be going well. Well, that doesn't depend on whether you choose to hold dollars. It might depend on whether you live in America. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure what. I don't have to look at it. Does the Federal Reserve Note say something about the full faith and credit?
That's something that people say, if it's not based on gold, then what is it based on? And that's what I hear people.
All this says is this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. So it does say that they will accept it in payment of taxes. And I'm not sure it implies much else. Yes, but I am. Yeah, right. I'm not sure. I'm not sure that does very much. Now, it was the case. I should say it was the case as recently as sometime in the '60s that some of the circulating money was silver certificates, and those were indeed a promise to pay a certain amount of silver in exchange. On the other hand, they were monetized at a price of silver higher than the real price. So what they were saying, in effect, was bring in a dollar and we'll give you 60 cents worth of silver. And at the point when the price of silver got high enough, so it was becoming bring in a dollar and we'll give you a dollar worth of silver, silver certificates vanished from circulation. They were no longer being printed. And as an individual, if you've got a piece of paper which in effect says if the price of silver goes down, this is worth a dollar. If the price of silver goes up, this is worth more than a dollar. That piece of paper is worth more than a dollar, and it's therefore foolish to spend it when you could be holding it on the hopes that the price of silver will go up. This is what's called Gresham's law, that cheap money drives out dear money. You have two pieces of paper that exchange of one for one, a silver certificate and a Federal Reserve note. You pay with the less valuable one. All right. And the more valuable one is out of circulation. But anyway, so you could have private money, and the obvious ways of having a private money are that the bank or whoever is issuing it does have a guarantee for something. They say, bring in our dollar and we will give you object X. And either you believe that because they're contractually obligated to it, or you believe it because you trust their reputation. Yeah.
That's like casinos, right? They give you those tokens that's private money.
In a way, I don't know that. I guess you could give it to someone else. I have a question. Do people in Las Vegas actually use this money? Is it not uncommon for somebody to go into a restaurant and he says, oh, sorry, I don't have any money here, and hand them a casino chip? They could, but I don't know. I guess they're less convenient than pay for money, not more. But
waiters are with it for sure.
What?
You said waiters are with it for sure.
You do? That's interesting. All right, well, that's going in that direction. You know, that's interesting. One obvious problem with a private money of that sort is being sure they can fulfill their contract. And there are then, in a sense, two different problems. One of them is it might be a fraud, but the other is that the bank might be perfectly honest but unlucky. You could imagine that typically, in order for the bank to pay its bills, it's normally going to have something less than 100% reserve. Right, 100% reserve system is one where they issue 1,000 pieces of paper saying good for 1 ounce of silver, and sure enough, there are 1,000 ounces of silver in the vault. And that is not a very profitable business because you've got some money to pay for your rent and your salaries, and you're getting nothing. So the more standard solution, fractional reserve, is you have 1,000 pieces of paper out there, you have 100 ounces of silver in your vault, and then you have other assets. Preferably interest-bearing assets, which are worth at least 900 ounces of silver. And then the theory is, if your people come in with their pieces of paper and you start running out of silver, you just buy some more silver. You sell some of your assets, buy silver. And that would be quite risky in the case where you really only had a total of 1,000 ounces worth of assets. Because if the price of silver goes up, you now owe 1,000 ounces, but you only have 800 ounces worth of assets because your other assets aren't silver. And one possible solution to that is to hold assets whose price is correlated, is related to the price of silver. So if you own stock in silver mines, say. But another solution, and the one that was used in Scotland, is to have assets much larger than your liabilities. So if the bank in question, in addition to these transactions, also happens to own $1 million worth of other stuff, then even if they lose a lot on the money, they'll still be able to fulfill. And the system in Scotland was that the banks were unlimited liability partnerships, and normally one of the partners was a wealthy individual. So since it was unlimited liability, that meant that you had a claim against everything he had for fulfilling his contractual obligation to redeem the currency. And you can imagine in a modern case, Apple Computer or IBM or Mr. Buffett, somebody who we know has lots of money, says, all right, I am issuing this currency, it's fractional reserve, but here's the amount I'm issuing, it's considerably less than my total assets, so the chance of the price of the commodities to find in going up by enough to cause a problem is very close to zero. So that would be a possible solution to that problem. You're the lawyers, or lawyers to be, I'm not. What legal problems would there be? Suppose somebody somewhere in the world issues a private money. It could be an e-cash or just ordinary money. Are there any restrictions to my using it in the U.S.? Yeah?
Just the extent
people
would accept it.
Yeah. That clearly. There's clearly a startup problem for any of these things. That's right. Yeah?
If you earn that money.
What?
That's
certainly one issue, is how does it fit in? But of course, you could be paid in kind, right? There's nothing illegal about taking part of your payment as housing, let us say, not an uncommon arrangement. Your employer provides you housing. And so presumably, in theory at least, you report the income, and there is an market exchange rate out there between the currencies. Now, one place where there is a problem, and a question which comes up when people start arguing for returns to the gold standard or something, or a private gold standard or something, which gets discussed a little by Ron Paul, I guess, and some of his people, and that is, if I'm using gold as money and the price of gold goes up, do I have to treat that as a capital gain? And I guess in principle the answer is no, because I haven't realized it yet. But if I do realize it, if I'm holding my money as gold, the price of gold goes up, I buy things, well, it looks as though at that point I ought to owe capital gains taxes. So that's one potential problem with interfacing such a thing with our present system. People do occasionally set up sort of relatively low-tech barter systems in which I've seen this sort of done in a particular town, basically, where people say, look, we'd be better off if we could all, in effect, create our own money and pay each other with it. And my guess is that they are partly an attempt to evade taxes, but that they might do that de facto, but not de jure. Yes, Ithaca dollars. Right, yeah. I don't know the details of how they do it, but I knew they had such a system. But anyway, so the obvious reason why governments, there are a couple of reasons why governments might dislike the idea of an anonymous e-cash in particular. One of them is that currently governments get seniorage. That is to say, if the total money supply expands, whoever prints that is in effect getting an interest-free loan. All right? And who gets it in our system is a little complicated because we have, in a sense, in terms of the economics, our monetary system is really bizarre. Because the real function of a fractional reserve system is to economize on the reserve commodity. All right, why does it make sense if you're using gold to use pieces of paper representing 10 grams of gold instead of 10 gram gold pieces? One of the major reasons is because we can use much less gold and have the same amount of currency because it's a fractional reserve. So we have a fractional reserve system. What is the reserve commodity which our fractional reserve banks are economizing on? Anybody know? They are economizing on paper money, or alternatively, on entries in the books of the Federal Reserve System. That a fiat system, the central argument for fractional reserve goes away because the money doesn't cost anything to produce, but for historical reasons we nonetheless have a fractional reserve system. And one result, I think, is that some of the seniorage is in effect going to banks and some of it is going to the original issuer to the Fed. So one reason might be that if you really had private money that largely replaced the dollar, well, one thing that would happen is you'd have a big inflation because you'd have the same number of dollars out there and less demand for them. So the dollars would lose their value, prices would go up. That doesn't look very good for whoever is running it. And in the long term, the government wouldn't get the implicit income from being able to print money. Yeah?
So by seniorage, you're saying that like if you could track the dollar that's created, by the time it gets to us, it's a lot more inflated?
No, it doesn't require inflation. Seniorage in general is the income from producing money. And the sort of standard version of seniorage is I mint a coin which is considered to be worth an ounce of silver, but only has 9/10 of an ounce of silver in it. So back when people were actually minting coins, seniorage is going to the senior, to the lord. That was the original context. But in the modern context, the form of seniorage, even with no inflation, there's still a positive interest rate. So suppose that I produce a million Friedman dollars. And in order to do that, I need to tie down $100,000 of actual resources of the silver, say. So when I use my million Friedman dollars to buy stuff from people. I buy $100,000 worth of my reserve commodity of silver. I buy $900,000 of T-bills or of Apple stock or whatever I think is a good investment or of land that I'm going to rent out. Let's suppose it's simply a fixed interest bond. Maybe it's company's bonds, if not T-bills. So I now have $900,000 earning me interest. I can pocket that interest until the money comes back, and it may never come back. If at some point people stop using my money, then they come in and they want their assets. Fine, I now have to liquidate, but I've gotten money during the period. So that's the implicit seniorage. Now there's an additional return if you have an inflation, because now the money that you pay them back eventually is going to be less. But with a commodity money, which is defined as an ounce of silver, there's no particular reason to expect it. To expect inflation. I should say there's an interesting historical bit this related to. There's quite a good book called Money, Prices, and Civilization in the Mediterranean World by an Italian economic historian called Carlo Cipolla, which means onion, by the way, for those of you who don't speak Italian. And he's discussing what he calls the dollars of the Middle Ages. That at various points during the medieval period, I guess into the Renaissance, one currency or another is the standard currency people are using for international transactions. So they, I think at the beginning of this period, they're using the numisma, which is the Byzantine gold coin, also called a bezant. And then later, I think there's some shift to the dinar, which is a Muslim gold coin. And then, as the Italian city-states become more and more important, you have the florin and, I think, the ducat at different points. And by his account, generally at any one time, there is one gold coin that is mostly used for international transactions. And his data suggests... Now, how do you inflate those? They're gold coins. The way you inflate them is to lower the weight. So you can say, well, we used to mint the numisma at 15 grams, but our new batch is going to be at 14 grams. With luck, nobody will notice, and they'll still accept them at the same value. All right? And his account is that the gold coinage being used for international trade was very, very stable. That, in fact, the inflation rate was, well, his figure for silver coinage at the same time was the inflation rate was that it roughly doubled every 200 years. Which by our standards is pretty good, but the gold was better than that. And he has an explanation, which I won't go into because I don't think it's right, but my explanation is that the gold currency was on a competitive market. If the Byzantines started inflating the numisma, pretty soon everybody would be using the dinar instead. That there were real benefits to Byzantium. They weren't really getting any seniorage if they were full weight numismas, but there were status benefits to the fact that the coinage everybody used is the Byzantine coinage. Look how important the Byzantine Empire is. There's actually a story about that, which I won't bother you with, about the dinar and the numisma. And therefore they had an incentive, whereas the silver coinage was local coinage, by his account, in a particular place people were doing their small transactions with the local silver coinage, so you'd get away with a little bit of inflation and people would keep using it. They didn't have a good alternative. So that was sort of interesting, in a sense, just as with my China to cyberspace. I think it's sort of neat when you can see the same economic patterns that I'm thinking about in terms of future high tech showing up 1,000 years ago or 500 years ago in some other setting, which this one is doing. So one other problem with private currencies is that it's convenient if you and your neighbor use the same money. And as anybody who's lived in Europe prior to recent years know, it's not intolerable if you don't. That the situation until euro became common was that you had a whole bunch of countries close to each other, each using its own currency. It was a little bit of a nuisance, but you know, people managed to live with it. I would argue that it would be less of a nuisance now, because what do I actually, suppose I go to Europe, which I'm probably going to do sometime after the semester is over for a week or two, how do I get currency, not being myself living in a euro area? How do I pay for things if I go to Europe nowadays? Yes? I take a credit card and I draw any currency I like out of a dollar account. All right? Because the bank's computers are doing the exchange for me. And that's much less trouble than my having to keep it in my head. Furthermore, I'm probably getting a better rate. You don't think so?
Borrower's rate.
Yeah, are you now?
They charge you a conversion fee also.
But the question is, what is the conversion fee compared to the money changer's conversion fee?
It's something like 20%.
I disagree.
You think that...
I think that the rate that you get withdrawing out of your own account is much better than if you walked up to, like, whatever they
have in the airport. The Combio, or... Yes. That's my impression. You can check next time you're... I don't know. My impression, at least when I looked at it some years ago, I had the situation as an original... recently was that you can usually see what the charge is at a Cambio because they both buy and sell. So you can look at what the difference is between the buy and the sell rate. And my impression was that although the bank charges you something, but I should check before I go abroad. You're right. That it usually charges less. Yes?
The thing is, when I get out money here, yep. Like the ATM charges me money for transferring money.
They're charging you for the transfer or just charging you for withdrawing money? Yes. Well, so that's an argument, if possible, for using a bank that exists in both countries. But the other thing is, if you're buying goods rather than getting money, then I think that one doesn't occur, but there's still going to be some conversion charge for their doing the transfer. But I guess the point I'm making is only that sort of almost invisibly our technological change has somewhat reduced the disadvantage of multiple monetary systems. Now, there's still some disadvantage because there's still the problem of knowing what things cost. So that if I go into a restaurant in France and I see the cost of this meal is so many francs, it's not as immediately obvious as if it was dollars to me, is this an expensive restaurant? And similarly for all sorts of things that are for sale. Now, if you're in a country for very long, you rapidly get in the habit of doing those conversions. So I'm not arguing there are no disadvantages to multiple systems. I'm just saying that it's sort of interesting that changes which weren't really designed to solve that problem have to some degree solve it. And I then sketch in the chapter how you could imagine more full-blown versions for online stuff where you post your price in rupees and I read it in dollars. I don't know about... I thought it was sort of funny. I noticed that when I was rereading the chapter that this is this far future situation where I'm using Firefox 9. And I think they're at 10 now, though I'm not sure. So maybe if I ever revise the book, I should make it Firefox 14 or something, or 15. But... anyway, that was sort of interesting. Let's see. So then I guess one of the questions is, can government stop it? Because the other reason governments would like to stop it, of course, is money laundering. That not only do governments try to use money laundering rules to prevent things they don't like, they also make money out of money laundering. That some years ago I got a phone call. Somebody who was inviting me to speak at a conference on money laundering in the Pacific Rim. And he identified himself as a forensic accountant, which I thought was an interesting profession. And my response to him was, you do realize that I'm in favor of money laundering? And he said, yes. And I went and gave a talk about some of this sort of stuff, that the tech stuff that's related. But it was interesting because it was a conference largely of law enforcement people. And I listened to their talks too, and one of them involved some particular project where I think they made, I don't know, $10 million, $15 million, very large amount of money by confiscating money, which they claimed probably truthfully was being used in criminal activities. So one effect of money laundering plus forfeiture rules, basically, is to have a way in which law enforcement can make money out of enforcing the law. So they would prefer to keep that, and I think it's clear if you look at my description of eCash that it really isn't practical to enforce money laundering laws once there's a fully anonymous eCash out there. Now, I'm in favor of money laundering because most of the laws that money laundering is used to enforce are laws that I don't think ought to be there. Drug and gambling, basically. On the other hand, suppose we abolish the war on drugs, legalize gambling, and what's money laundering being used for? Payments on kidnapping or on other forms of extortion. Then now I'd be in favor of money laundering, and you would then have enforcing laws against money laundering, and you then have the trade-off between the fact that having anonymous e-cash arise means that certain desirable laws are harder to enforce, at the same time that it also has advantages for individual privacy and so forth. So some of these questions do hinge on sort of how you look at government in between benevolent helper and legitimized criminal gang, which are sort of, in a sense, the two poles of people's views of government, and I think most of us have at least some element of both of them in our minds. But many of these issues, really, anywhere on that range, some of the same questions. I mean, even a legitimized criminal gang might find it interesting to do some useful things, like protecting us from other criminal gangs, which could be a desirable thing. In any case, so there are reasons why governments don't like the idea. And my guess is that that's part of the reason we don't have an anonymous e-cash yet. It would be interesting, at some point I ought to see if I have a chance to talk to the guy who started PayPal. Because his original plan, he actually gave a talk, may even have been here. I remember a talk I was at, and I think it may have been here like 15 years ago or something. And at that point, what he was trying to create was a system using, I think it was Palm Pilots at the time, but basically some sort of PDA. I think that was pre-cell phone, but I'm not sure, for making it possible all over the world to make anonymous cash transactions. And obviously he abandoned that business plan and ended up with a very successful business plan, which is not anonymous, namely PayPal. And it'd be interesting to know whether it was because he felt that the pressure from governments would be too strong or there were other problems with what he wanted to do. But in any case, you can see that governments wouldn't like it, that the U.S. government could surely suppress it in the U.S. if they wanted to. Now, what they might do is compromise, that there was the trial attempt with the Mark Twain Bank that David Shaum did, which was a semi-anonymous e-cash where one party plus the bank could identify the other party, and it may be that it was that. Maybe Chaum preferred it that way, or maybe it was that way because they thought it would be less likely to be objected to. But the difficulty from the standpoint of a government that wants to prevent it is that it doesn't have to be done in its territory. So that if you think about how the Internet works, a single Swiss bank with the permission of the Swiss government could provide anonymous e-cash for the world. And, you know, Switzerland is uppity enough, they might do it. So that... something I think is an asset, at a point that's going to come up later, but you can all see as a liability, is that we live in a multi-jurisdictional world. And a multi-jurisdictional world means that suppressing technological developments is much harder. And, you know, the U.S. would sort of like to think that it's living in a world where nobody can do anything the U.S. really objects to. But I think Iran is providing us quite a lot of evidence to the contrary just at the moment, and other people have at other times. And, you know, if I can see the argument that there are many countries which, if they wanted to permit an anonymous e-cash and the U.S. government and the German government and a few other governments that it's a really terrible idea, would back down, that we can put pressure on them. But I think there are enough places like China which wouldn't back down or wouldn't have to back down, so that my guess is, now this is a case where I've made a false prophecy in the past, so it's a little dangerous because I'm sure I predicted e-cash at some point in the past that should be here by now. But my guess is still that eventually it's going to happen, because it seems to me that as long as it can be done in any one place, it's hard to suppress. But we will see. Anyway, it's one of the possible features of a future system, and as I think may have been clear in the discussions earlier, it's one useful block if you imagine you're trying to imagine a future of strong privacy online. Being able to pay secretly is a very useful part of that technology. Other things. My notes. All right, so let me, assuming that nobody has any other questions about e-cash, or private monies, or any of that stuff, let's go on to contracts. Yeah?
I have a question about private money, but yes. Not necessarily electronic money.
Yeah, sure.
How do you envision the counterfeit problem? Now, basically, you have all these people yes. that have a massive structure for counterfeiting.
Yes, but presumably, you've got the same problem now, that if you have a private paper money, you imagine a private currency, it's being openly issued within some country. You presumably are issuing it in a country where you believe they will try to enforce counterfeiting laws. It's counterfeiting stuff that isn't government issued is still illegal, right? It's still fraud. Depending on the details of the law. But if anybody's curious, you can look at that. There's got to be some case law on it, because the U.S. had wildcat banking in the 19th century. There were lots of private banks issuing their own money. But for that matter, suppose you counterfeited American Express traveler's checks at the moment. What's the legal status of that? I bet it's illegal somehow. It's got to be. No. Because they're a sort of a private money. They aren't a currency. They don't pass from hand to hand the same way. But they are a kind of a private money. Yeah. Might be, yeah. Yeah, my guess is that it isn't the same thing as counterfeiting, but that it is, in fact, illegal. And therefore, the only question is how good a job the government does in enforcing it. But one of the nice things about eCash is that there really are ways of making counterfeiting pretty much impossible using public key encryption kinds of methods. So, you know, take the simplest version of eCash, which doesn't work because you can double spend, and that's where what I'm giving you for a dollar is a file or a piece of information or something which is digitally signed with the bank's private key. Everybody has the bank's public key so they can see if it was signed by it. Nobody else can produce things. They can make exact copies of that one, of course, but they can't produce new ones. And since the bank is only willing to fulfill one of those, if they make a copy, they aren't stealing from the bank, they're stealing from you, so you won't let them make the copy. Right? So that problem is soluble there. Anybody know what the great 20th century counterfeiting coup was? The one that brought down the government? And I think resulted in a fairly stable dictatorship for quite a long time? Portugal. Some clever, enterprising criminals got to the, I think, British printing firm that printed the Portuguese money and somehow put in a bogus order and got them to print up for themselves a lot of Portuguese money, which then went into circulation, which then caused all sorts of problems in Portugal. And Salazar was, I think, maybe the economics minister at the time. And he somehow, I don't know how he dealt with it, but somehow he dealt with the crisis in some way that was sufficiently successful, so he ended up ruling Portugal for, I don't know, the next 20 years or something. So that's sort of an interesting case. He may be the only modern dictator who was an economist, I'm not sure. But
anyway, any more questions on either private money or e-cash? Because they're not the same thing, but they're related. And of course, an e-cash could be a government money. There's no particular reason why. You might argue if the U.S. was really clever, they would say to themselves, look, we've read this stuff by Friedman, and it sounds pretty unbelievable, but if in 10 years somebody is going to put out an anonymous e-cash, well, we're already putting out anonymous paper cash, after all. That's the business we've been in for a few hundred years. So, I don't know how long it was the U.S. I think we're using paper money, because colonials were paper money. So the U.S. has been using paper money from the beginning. So why don't we preempt? Why don't we bring out an anonymous e-cash? And not only will we now have the seniorage, we'll have the seniorage from the entire world. Because if, after all, the U.S. is regarded as a highly reliable issuer, the dollar is the standard currency of the world already. We're the numisma of the 20th century. So, therefore, if we issue dollar-denominated, fully anonymous e-cash, everybody in the world will use it, and we will get all of the advantages. That is true, we won't be able to enforce our money laundering rules anymore, but we can enforce them a little better because criminals are going to be suspicious that maybe there's some trick to the e-cash and that they can't trust it. And in any case, if someone else issues anonymous e-cash, we can't enforce them anyway, at least. So that's an interesting thought. I don't think it's going to happen. Well, if Newt Gingrich were president, it might happen. Not because I'm a supporter of Newt Gingrich, but because he's crazy. He's the kind of person who... And I think he's got to be about the most interesting of the candidates. I'm somewhat frightened at the picture of actually seeing him as president, because he's a loose cannon, so to speak. But he's an interesting loose cannon. He comes up with bizarre ideas. So maybe he would do it, but I can't imagine. Well, I guess Ron Paul would not object to private e-cash, but I don't think non-Ron Paul would be in favor of having the government get involved in the e-cash business. That's socialism, right? Yeah, I agree. It is. But yeah, people, it's funny, I was thinking of the word socialism, but I had the experience online when I point out perfectly accurately that something or other is socialism in the normal economist sense. The public school system is socialist, right? It's a means of production owned and run by the state. That's what socialism means. But socialist becomes so much sort of a pejorative term rather than a descriptive term that people think that that's attacking something. I think I was incorrectly suggesting that Ron Paul believed that the U.S. government ought to have a monopoly of issuing money. And I was saying, see, in that respect, he's a socialist, too. Turns out I was wrong. It turns out that Ron Paul does, in fact, have no objection to competing private money. He says,
a commenter on my blog pointed out to me. But it isn't. And the same thing, I guess, is true of communists, that arguably the communist states weren't communists in the sense they didn't have common ownership of everything. But there have been, you know, small communist units. You could argue that many families are communist units, that stuff is owned in common. And yet people think of communists as if it's a evil, diabolical, rather than a descriptive term, which, as I say, does not describe very well the societies that called themselves communists. They were, even in their own terms, they were communists in the sense they thought the final state they were evolving to was common ownership, but not that that's what they had at the time. They had the dictatorship of the proletariat, which is a different system. Anyway, long digression. So let's go back to, let me go to the subject of contracts. People are finished with e-cash. How about the contract stuff, which again, as I hope you could see, I was having fun with that article and sort of tying together Imperial Chinese practice, tying together my two seminars, basically. The other one was where I got this information on Imperial China, and this one was on cyberspace. So, do people follow? Let me start with what it seems to me is one of the important and fairly simple points, which is why the critical thing for reputational enforcement is low costs to interested third parties. Do people follow that argument? In order for reputational enforcement to work, pretty much, it has to be inexpensive for the third party who is using the reputational information to get it. Is that argument clear? I think it's a fairly important point, and not one that I've often seen made. That if I cheat you and you complain about it, if he can't tell which one of us is lying, both of us lose reputation. Right? Because, of course, after I cheat you, I'm going to claim you were cheating me. I mean, you're just trying to cover it up by making wild accusations at me. So he concludes one or the other of us is a cheater, maybe both of us are. He therefore chooses not to do business with either of us. The result is that you are worse off for having reported my cheating. The result is you won't report my cheating. The result is reputational enforcement stops working. All right? So it seems to me that that's... So we usually think of it in the sort of face-to-face context where you say, well, it's easy enough. He knows you. He knows you're a reasonable, honest guy and you wouldn't have said things like that if it weren't true. That solves the problem. But if you're imagining reputational enforcement in an anonymous marketplace like the internet, that breaks down pretty quickly, and now we need some easy way for interested third parties to figure out who to believe.
Is a consumer and a seller, right?
That's one context, not the only context.
So the third party is going to be
the other consumer.
The buyer has more to, sorry, seller. The seller has more to lose than the buyer, I think.
That's right. That's right. And the reason for that has a different difference, and that is that reputation matters mostly to repeat players. So in that particular market, typically, buyers are much larger than sellers. Sellers are much larger than buyers. That you have many customers for a given firm, and therefore the cost to get of a bad reputation is likely to be higher. Or putting it differently, it's much easier for the buyers to research the sellers than for the sellers to research every possible buyer. And one implication of that, which I think I do discuss, is if you're worried about the problem of opportunistic breach, which in a sense is the central problem here. There are two kinds of breach, two useful kinds. One of them is efficient breach. An efficient breach is where, on net, fulfilling the contract is going to make us worse off. We thought it would make us better off, something has changed. And a well-designed contractual system or legal system, the efficient breach happens, the only question is who bears what cost from it. Opportunistic breach is the case where breaching the contract makes us on net worse off, but it makes me better off. And that's the case where I sell you something, you pay me, I don't deliver. All right, well, I've gained by that. All right. So then you want to use reputational enforcement to prevent that. And there the argument is, one way of doing it is to set up, if you can, to set up, think about a contract performance over time, which a lot of contracts are about. Can you set it up so there's no point at which either party is better off walking out of it? And sometimes you can. Sometimes you can, except circumstances change. Sometimes you can't. That, in a sense, the clearest case there, when I discuss, is a contract by which you agree to sell me wheat in 3 months at a given price. All right. If that's all we've got in the contract, then if the price of wheat goes up, you are better off reneging on the contract. If it goes down, I'm better off reneging on the contract. So given that situation, if we have a reason why we want to do it that way, I want to hedge basically on wheat, then we need to have at least one of us have a reputation and then change the contract in such a way that that's the only one who will pay to renege. So we suppose we say that you, the seller, have a reputation and I don't. So when we think the price of wheat is not going to change by more than 10%, so I prepay 10%. Now, if I renege, you keep my prepayment, so I'm worse off. And you won't renege. It would pay you to renege. You'd get my prepayment. Assuming the price of wheat goes up, you get the prepayment. You'd sell the wheat to someone else at a higher price. But that will wreck your reputation. Nobody will buy wheat from you again. So one, it seems to me, simple but fairly important solution to the problem of opportunistic breach is if you can, structure the contract so that it never pays either side to breach. If you can't, make sure that the only person that pays to breach is the one who has reputational incentives not to. Let me suggest that this particular bit of the course ought to be of interest to you for reasons that have nothing to do with high tech or with China. Because you're in a system where contracts are enforceable in the courts. If you are a good contract lawyer, it won't happen. All right? Part of what you want your lawyer to do if you're writing a contract is to make sure it'll never get to court, because courts are expensive. All right? So in that sense, one of the interesting things about looking at things like that Chinese case, where people had to do their contracting without a court enforcement, is that it teaches you useful lessons about how you, operating in a modern system where if all else fails you can sue the guy, still ought to try to design contracts so as to minimize the chance left. So does that make sense? Okay. I mean, most of what I teach in my weird seminars is not really of use to practicing lawyers. It's from my standpoint, it's intellectually interesting, it's sometimes exciting. Some of the stuff here is because you're going to live long enough so some of these things will happen. But mostly it's really for the intellectual fun of understanding things. But this, I think, is an exception. If you,
isn't this difficult to do, for society to have efficient regions, right? Because, there's two cases. You said there's one that,
take efficient reach.
And this is, but this is like a cost against efficient reach. So
why is it an efficient reach?
Because, you're putting this extra cost of reputation on it, right?
Of course, but the reputational cost is for breaching without the permission of the other party. Well, putting under the reputational clause is for breaching, but I haven't breached the contractual terms saying that I'm to follow circumstances like and back out. Right. But also, for a moment, if you're willing to ignore sort of bargaining clauses, all you need for efficient breach is freedom of contract, because when the breach becomes efficient, there is then some price I will pay you for permission to breach. All right. So it's only the fact that that sets up a bargaining game which might have problems that prevents it. The standard sort of modern law solution is expectation damages, where if I breach, I have to make you as well off as if I hadn't breached. And if you really have that rule working, and if you can measure the things, then I only breach when my gain is by doing your loss, which is what you want me to breach. But
I would compare that conditional payment to the reputation cost, right?
But you can have a contract with suppose there's no court, but suppose there's a way in which third parties can find out if I breach. The terms of my contract are I am entitled to not deliver the wheat if X happens. Or I'm entitled to not deliver the wheat if I'm willing to pay you an amount that compensates you for not delivering the wheat. Then I haven't breached, so the reputational effects are never triggered. You think about the mechanism I discussed in the chapter, which is one that I find sort of interesting, where you use digital signatures in order to reduce the cost the third party to essentially zero. So what do? Go back a step. If you agree that the critical thing for reputational enforcement is low cost signatures of third parties, I'm claiming that the real function of arbitration, it's a little tricky,
In our legal system, arbitration is often enforced in enforcement court. But that's not true in all international contexts. It's not true in all historical contexts. So think for a minute about arbitration in contexts where it's not enforced in courts, which certainly has existed in some places, still doesn't exist. Now I'm arguing that you can think of the function of that arbitration as lowering the information cost to third parties. Because as long as it's public knowledge that you and I agreed that he'd be our arbitrator, all the third party has to do is to ask him, did they act according to your arbitrated verdict? All right? So then my online version of that, which as far as I can tell will work, I don't know if anybody's doing it, is that our contract is digitally signed by both of us. The contract includes the public key of the arbitrator and says he's the arbitrator. And now, if one of us thinks the other is breached, it goes to the arbitrator gives a verdict, the arbitrator digitally signs that verdict, we put it up on a web page, which has our names all over it, so anybody who's interested in us can find it, and lo and behold, that digital signature proves that he says that I cheated you, and our signed contract proves that I agreed to have him be the arbitrator. So that's sort of the fairly clean way of solving the costs of the third party problem.
Would the arbitration be face to face?
Not in this context. No, we I don't even know if you're a man or a woman, or you know, you could be a computer program for all I know, right? No, that's right. I'm considering the case where it's all being done online. Now, in the real world, arbitration largely is face to face. Yeah, it's a question which, in a sense, is related indirectly to this and a bunch of other stuff we do. Which I don't have really adequate answers, is when does face-to-face matter and why? And the puzzle that bothered me for a very long time, which is related to this, is one form of education is the large lecture. All right, and the typical large lecture, the number of students is large enough so there's minimal interaction. Why didn't that vanish with the invention of the printing press? Pre-printing press, that was a very sensible way of spreading knowledge. Because the students can take notes, and you are thus making 1,000 copies of what the professor has to say, essentially. And without a printing press, that's the best way of doing it. Once you have a printing press, it seems to me as though a book ought to dominate a lecture. Because if you're lucky, you can get hear a lecture by the best lecturer in your university. But you can read a book that's the best book in that field that anybody in the world ever wrote. All right. So you can get a higher quality product. Furthermore, a lecture is given at a particular time. Well, the lecture is at 10 o'clock in the morning. I don't like waking up at 10 in the morning. If I do, I'm not only half awake. My wife used to say that what she didn't like about working for Shell Oil in New Orleans was that she had to go to work an hour and a half before she woke up, which she did. That made her less functional for the first hour, 2 hours, I don't know what she said, but something like that. She's a geologist, or was a geologist. On average, men are supposed to be better than women at mapping. My wife was in the business of deducing three-dimensional maps in order to find the oil. I even have a World of Warcraft character who introduces himself to people he's doing things with by warning them that he can get lost on a tabletop. So we're experimental error on that particular pattern. But anyway, where was I? That's the trouble with these digressions. Sometimes they're taking the name you lost. What was I talking about?
Why the
lecture didn't. So, but you can read the book if the time when you're wide awake is 10 at night or 1 in the morning, you can read the book then. If a lecture goes on at a constant speed for everybody. So that means that half the time you already understand what he's saying, you're wasting your time. And half the time you got lost 4 or 5 minutes before you're wasting your time. The book. Chapter. I understand that I'm going to read the next chapter. Can't make sense with this. Go back to the beginning of your reading. And yet, despite all of that, there is still some teaching, substantial amounts of teaching, that's done in large lectures. And my guess is that it has something to do with this face-to-face business. That somehow, human beings have some flaw in their programming, such you don't really believe it, or you somehow believe it less, or it somehow works less for you. If there aren't other human beings visibly present in the room.
Attendance requirement.
But why aren't universities that way driven off the margin by other universities? And not all universities do. Now, I should say, it may be that the answer is that Oxford and Cambridge are the proof that my original claim is right. Because Oxford and Cambridge, their system is that there are large lectures with no compulsory attendance. There are then very short, very small, one student to three students or something, sort of seminars, meeting once a week for an hour or two with the teacher. And then there are exams at the end of it. So the system, which strikes me as a more attractive system than ours, in the sense that you're really saying to the student, you decide how to educate yourself, we'll just decide whether you've succeeded. Yep.
So Salman Khan's Khan Academy has a very similar system that you're working on
right
now. And the idea is that you work classroom to be more like a formal session, and being at home is where you read the lectures or watch the lectures until you get it.
Yes.
And then the face-to-face is actually to where you talk to where you got stuck.
Yes.
So
right. Well, maybe it's just that the process is a little bit slower. You know, Gutenberg wasn't that long ago. But it struck me as a puzzle a long time ago. I tried an experiment once at Tulane, I think. I had just written, but I did not yet publish my price theory textbook. And I was teaching the course that generated that textbook. And so I said, all right, I'll give the students printouts, Xeroxes or whatever they were at the time, with each chapter. And it's very simple. This is the chapter for today. Read it before we come into class. I will come into class. I will ask if you have any questions, and we'll go home. Didn't work. The students hated it, so I stopped doing it that way. But
I don't know what?
That I don't know. All I know is they were unhappy. You can argue that somehow people are so undisciplined that you've got to tie them to the desk to get that and talk at them instead of just handing them a book and telling them to say, maybe that's it. But given how expensive our schooling system is, I don't want to say educational system, only parts of it are educational system, but given how expensive our schooling system is, it's hard to believe that if there was a much cheaper way that worked really well, it wouldn't have largely taken over large parts of the world right now. And yet, as far as I can tell, it hasn't. I mean, we don't do only large lectures, but why are large lectures still a significant part? Maybe the internet is going to change that, but so far.
Well, right from the work experience, that we find that if you want to really get some real work done, that you want to resolve problems, the only way to do it is to pay them this candidate.
But that's exactly the same question. Why? Because this is getting into our subject. What are the limits of virtual firms?
People behave very differently. It's easier than anonymous or just text.
Wouldn't you have to be anonymous? I know who you are.
Well, even not anonymous, I mean, through
you're an
interface. They behave very differently in emails and IMs and telephones. It's not when they come to the face-to-face with people, their demeanor changes or something.
What if you use a video phone, which you can do for free with Skype? Almost free.
Yeah. I think that's almost there, but not quite maybe, but it's almost there.
Because this is relevant to a whole bunch of stuff, how the internet affects it, to what extent. The experience I have, which is in a way related to this, is years ago, I gave a lecture in Italy from here over the telephone. And it was just terrible. It felt terrible to me. I was like talking into a well. A year or so later, I gave one in Holland. I think that's where it was. Again from here. But this time, it was in a high-tech room that I think the business school had, where I was looking at a wall that appeared to be a wall of glass with my audience on the other side. They were presumably looking at something similar with me on the other side. And it wasn't as good as if I was doing it. It was much, much, much closer. So maybe the answer is just technology is a little bit better. And what determines it, I don't know. Suppose you see people, but it's not really them. Suppose we're using things like World of Warcraft characters. Does that push the right button in the brain, as it were, such that you feel as though you're interacting with another person? I mean, in a way, multiplayer online games would be an interesting research area to see sort of how much of a simulation of reality does it take before people somehow believe it's real. I don't know if that's what's happening, but somehow, whatever the difference is between the same conversation over a telephone and the conversation face-to-face, how much do we have to add before we get it? That's an interesting question, right? Somebody must be researching, but not me. Yes. Have any of you read Snow Crash? No. Snow Crash is a science fiction novel, pretty good science fiction novel. rather weird science fiction novel, sort of a tongue-in-cheek one. And one of its features is a virtual reality world, which in that sort of not very far future, maybe 50 years in our future, 30 years. And there's a virtual reality world with a lot of stuff happening. And one of the characters is a woman who was part of the team that designed it. And her critical breakthrough was realizing faces matter, which all the other people thought was not important. And figuring out sort of how people, because really, you may not want your thing online to actually look like you, that's one possibility, but figuring out what is the signals by which things we do with our face express emotions, you know, convey stuff and so forth, and basically the world worked a whole lot better once you did.
Yeah, so that's like, if you're just typing an email, it takes a lot of effort to get your tone right, the demeanor, how it comes across, it takes a lot of art and the rewriting all the time. Now, that comes naturally when you're speaking to somebody, or even if you didn't say it correctly, but when you look at their face, the other part of the brain then puts it in context. When you're looking at email, there's no such thing to...
Back to my case, though, of the textbook versus the lecture, because the difference between that case and your case is the textbook is not being written by a random person quickly. The textbook you're reading is being written by somebody who's really good at writing textbooks. That's why you're reading that one. And he didn't do it at the rate at which you write email. He went over and over it. One of the things I can say that I deliberately do in my writing is try to make it feel as though there's a human being behind the page. So that some of the things I throw in my books, things like references to Lord of the Rings or to dressed out detective stories or various other things, I'm putting them in partly so that the reader will say, aha, here's a real human being who's talking to me. It's not just a logical structure of argument kind of thing. And I think that is deliberately try to get that illusion. But as I'm still not satisfied. I know why the lecture survived, and yet you've got to face the fact it did survive. Therefore, my proof has to be wrong. You know, and in a certain sense, it's very helpful when you can prove something isn't true. Because you say, I know, I can follow the steps of the proof. I can observe the conclusion is wrong. Now I've got to figure out where's my mistake. What assumption am I making that isn't true? So if any of you answered, solve that problem, please tell me. Because I've been worrying about it for 20 years or so. Maybe longer than that. I think that, yeah, Tulane, oh God. Tulane must be about 30 years ago.
So I've been worrying about it for at least 30 years, maybe longer. All right, let me go back for a moment to the issue of establishing a reputation. Because this is also a real world issue. That one way of doing it, the slow way of establishing a reputation, is by lots of small transactions that I say, you know, you're willing to trust them, I'm not going to shoot you out of $3. You and many of us dealt with me for $3, but well, yeah, by that time he's not going to shoot you out of $10, and eventually you build it up. But there are other ways. And one real-world way is for me to make a visible expenditure whose purpose is establishing a reputation. It's almost a lifting yourself by your bootstraps. It's paradoxical in one sense. But imagine that I set up my firm, and the first thing I do is to visibly make a $100,000 donation to the Electronic Freedom Foundation, EFF, which is an organization that many people in this world the world I'm dealing with, I don't mean this world, I mean the world I'm dealing with, on cyberspace. So they, first, I'm a good guy. But second, why did I make that donation? Well, maybe I'm just a generous guy, but no, I made that donation in order to establish the fact that I am somebody who wants people to trust me. And if I then double-cross you, I've just blown that donation. All right? And the two examples, non-cyberspace examples, which I've seen discussed in this. One of them is the question of why bank buildings tended traditionally to be big, fancy buildings. Why do you have a marble facing on your bank building? And the answer is, especially if you go back a while, that when I opened the bank, people are a little worried that maybe I'll run away with their money. Well, I can't run away with my marble facing. So if I have visibly made a sunk cost which is only valuable by staying in business, that is some reason to expect me to stay in business. And that, I could argue, is the equivalent of money. But you can also argue that advertising campaigns serve this function. But advertising is a little bit puzzling. Some of it clearly gives information.
Some of it, you can argue, is just playing off the irrationalities of the customers. I'm not sure if either of those is an adequate explanation. And a third explanation is, by visibly spending money on advertising, that I'm trying to build up a brand name, a reputation, that evaporates if I get a bad reputation. Therefore, people are more irrationally motivated to trust me. So that's another possible. And that one you can do online, I think, so that would be one approach to dealing with some of these things.
So other things that occur to people that they want to talk about while I go look at my notes and see if there's anything else I want to talk about. Speak fast. Let me talk a little bit about hostages. Because hostages are an interesting idea, which, again, I really thought about more seriously when I was writing about that piece. Because the basic problem, which we've already discussed, is that when I prepay for the week, I lower my incentive for opportunistic reach, but I raise your incentive for opportunistic reach. So if neither of us has enough of a reputational incentive, we got a problem. And one solution is that I prepay with something that will hurt me to lose, but it won't help you to get. And that, I would argue, is the traditional idea of giving a hostage. And I even have a story that goes with it. It's even a true story. Does anybody here know who William Marshall was? No medieval historian types. William Marshall was born the fourth son of a minor baron. I don't know how much English people know, but a little bit after the Norman Conquest, there's a very unpleasant civil war between two claimants to the crown, Stephen and Matilda, civil war. And William's is the son of a minor baron during that period. Before he dies, he's regent of England. In between, he is a top tournament knight in Western Europe. He is a man who I like to imagine thinking of Richard the Lionhearted as a talented amateur. He's a contemporary, an older contemporary of Richard's. But in any case, when he's a kid, his father, Gilbert Marshall, is quite an honest and honorable man as English lords during that civil war goes, because he only switches sides once. He starts out supporting Stephen, and he then switches to Matilda. She offers him better terms or something, and he is then loyal to Matilda for the rest of the next 10 years or something. At one point during that period, Stephen shows up with an army in front of the castle that Gilbert is holding and threatens to take the castle, the siege, the castle, or stronger or something. And Gilbert says, look, that's a real pain for both of us. I got a deal on it. Here's the deal. You agree that I can send a message to Matilda, the person I'm fighting for, and ask her to bring an army and relieve the siege, to bring an army into battle. If she does, you and she can fight now. If she doesn't do it in 3 days, I'll surrender. So that way, that'll save you the trouble of the siege and getting people killed. And Stephen says, sounds like a good deal, but how do I know you'll keep your word? Well, Gilbert says, I got this kid, William, my son. You can take him, you can kill him if I double-cross you. Stephen, who is perhaps more trusting than his occupation at the time would have indicated, agrees to this deal. Stephen has other things to do with his army, so it goes off and besieges some other castle. Gilbert spends 3 days hiring troops, bringing in supplies, and getting ready for a siege, because he, like Stephen, knows that Matilda does not have an army free to relieve the siege in the next 3 days. Stephen comes back and says, all right, 3 days, surrender. And Gilbert says, ha ha, fooled you. And Stephen says, I'll kill the kid. And Gilbert says, have I not three more? And the hammer and the anvil with which to forge another? And Stephen, who is, I think, a little bit too tender-hearted for somebody engaged in a civil war over the crown of England, eventually does not kill William, which has profound effects for the next 40 years, I mean, the 50 years of English history, as it turns out. At one point, he's planning to shoot William over the walls from a siege engine, and William says, oh, great, playground equipment, let me fly one. And in general, he's apparently a sufficiently charming kid, so that Stephen backs down. But that's the hostage story. It didn't work in that case. But the basic idea is that if I can give you something which you don't want to seize, but I do want you to not seize, then you can penalize me by breaking the contract. And the I suggested in the article that you can think of reputation as being a hostage. That after all, when you publicly go to some trouble to publicly proclaim that I cheated you, you aren't getting anything out of that. But I'm losing something from that. And similarly, in the Chinese system, you could think of your reporting need to the district magistrate as being a hostage. It doesn't get you anything, but it hurts me. It may even hurt you a bit, given that legal system. So in that sense, that's another way of sort of you think about structuring contracts. Are there ways of structuring it that are the equivalent of that? Ways in which, if one side breaks it, the other side can hurt him, but it's not in his interest to do it unless that. Now, the nice thing, of course, about the reputational case and the court case is that the hostage, to some extent, only exists when you cheat me. Because until then, if I complain to the magistrate, you'll point out to the magistrate you've done nothing wrong. So that's the sort of the ideal case. But the pure hostage case, the one problem with it, which was pointed out by my daughter when she was auditing this class many years ago, back before she went to college, is the Coase theorem gets in the way, because while it's true that the hostage I've given you is of no value to you, it's of value to me, so you can threaten to kill it unless I buy it back from you. So there is a bit of a problem in making hostages work, in that there is some danger that the thing that's supposed to be of no value to you will be indirectly of value to you. This is why that article has a footnote attributed to R. Friedman, who all readers will assume is my mother, Rose Friedman, but in fact is my daughter, Diane Friedman, who made what I thought was a very good point when we discussed it. All right, we're past time.
Is there anybody here who has not put himself or herself on the seating chart? Because if you are, this is your chance.